Cape Talk. Family Matters.
This Parent Talk live studio audience is brought to you by KidZone. We deliver smiles. We deliver a live studio audience with us today. Thank you so much to everybody who's joined us in the studio. And thank you to those of you listening at home as well. You may or may not know that September is Literacy Month, and it's a great pleasure to be hosting today's live studio audience, talking about something which is one of my absolute passions, and that is reading. Anyone who knows me knows that if my head is stuck in a book, it's virtually impossible to get it out of that book, and my attention will be distracted. So I'm going to indulge that passion over the course of this hour, not so much for my own benefit, but talking about why it's so important for you to be reading to your children, your grandchildren, the children you encounter in daily life, why we need to be exposing children to the concept of storytelling and reading books from very, very early on in life. And I don't just mean the needs of developing their ability to read itself, to engage with schooling material. There is much, much more to it than that. And our panel of guests today includes an occupational therapist and a speech language therapist who are going to give us some perspective on what children actually learn through reading, what skills they develop through that process of listening to a story and later on learning to read for themselves. We're also going to chat to the Nalibali campaign, which does such amazing work promoting a culture of loving reading and of storytelling. And we'll hear from an acclaimed children's author and illustrator about just what it takes to get into the mind of a child and write and produce a book that they will want to pick up and read. I know we also have representatives of several different literacy and reading and storytelling groups in the audience with us today. Thank you for being here. And a note that if you would like to join those conversations, ask a question, or share something that you've learned through your process, just stick up your hand, please. My producer, Amy, has a roving microphone we'll bring to you so that you can join the conversation. To those listening at home, you are not exempt. Please remember to join in by SMS to 31567. You can send a WhatsApp message to 072-567-1567. You're also most welcome to tweet us at Cape Talk or to give me a call on 021-446-0567. Now, to start the conversation, I thought we should start with looking at some of the physical aspects of the development implications of reading to children, with children, for children. And delighted to welcome to our studio today two guests for this first part of the conversation. Roxanne Atkinson, it's a welcome back again as a repeat
Thanks
guest.
For having you.
Pediatric occupational therapist with a special interest in neurodevelopmental theory. And Roxanne has worked both in private practice and in state facilities, including the Red Cross War Memorial Children's Hospital. We're also delighted to have speech language therapist Elizabeth Nadelinier, who's been working in that field since 1992. Over the years, she's been involved in running teams of speech-language therapists offering interventions at school level, and more recently has helped develop the Virtual Reading Gym, a concept that aims to offer interventions for children who are struggling with reading, even those who can't afford private therapy. So lovely to have you both with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Pippa.
Roxanne, let me start with you. I mean, obviously it's essential that children learn to read so that further down the line they can read to learn what they need to learn. But it's much more than just the acquisition of knowledge that's at play here. What are the other developmental processes that are affected by our literacy learning?
Pippa, thanks for the question. It's so lovely to see children in the first year of life learning to sit on a parent's lap and have what we call joint attention, which means they're looking at the same material and they are living it out together. And it doesn't have to be long, a long length in time, but it's creating a little bit of a memory, and it's something to go back to each day and that they can build on. And it's something measurable. So you can say, my child can sit for 2 minutes and read 3 pages, or actually we're doing this book over and over again, I better, you know, upgrade. But also looking at bonding and that socio-emotional bond that creates an atmosphere of trust, which means that that child is going to try difficult things. So when things are tough and they're learning new skills, whether it's reading or maybe talking about getting a new baby brother or sister, it's a neutral space to talk about those things, but it also means that there's that trust so that they are willing to step out and try difficult stuff. And I always say we can do hard things together. Mm-hmm. And I think if that is in place and there's a strong bond, then a kid is already on the road to success with reading.
I'm glad you mentioned the element of repetition. And somebody actually SMS'd me a little while ago saying it's so good for language development to repeat the same stories and the same rhymes over and over, moving from a passive vocabulary into an active vocabulary. Could you maybe expand on what that means?
To me, what that means is if we think about books like Dr. Seuss and Cat in the Hat, there's a pattern, the words are simple, they have nice hard consonants in them, and it means that for younger kids, they can start by practicing those patterns like they would through singing a rhyme, and slowly they can take those words on and produce them themselves. So they're not only listening or expecting what mom and dad are going to say, but they can anticipate it and say it too. So in our home, we have some really cute video footage of our kids learning Cat in the Hat, and you stop just before the last word and they say it, and they're only about two, and it's just gorgeous and cute. But they feel like they're succeeding. They feel like little rock stars because they know, you know, what's coming next, and they will tell you they can read.
Well, we've got that cute video somewhere in my home of me sitting on a hospital bed reading Madeleine to my grandfather upside down. The book is upside down, I should say. But that was my learning to read an entire book. It was actually learning it by rote. And it's amazing how the repetition becomes such a thing of bonding and love. For my children, it was Sam McBratney's Guess How Much I Love You. I could probably still recite it to this day because I had to read it every single night for something like 3 years between the two kids. Why is it, do you think, that repetition it plays such a role in this process? I mean, you've said the importance of helping them learn and know that they've mastered that skill. Is it also about predictability and the safeness of knowing what's coming next?
Those two words are perfect, predictability and safeness. Children like to know what is coming next, and they don't understand the concept of time. So story time becomes a marker in their day of mum and dad are home, I'm safe, we're winding down, it's time for sleep, and it's something that also invest, they know that they are important, they're invested in, and I think that children, it's like part of the routine, and to know that they are loved, that this is the thing we do together, it creates that ritual, and that is what family is. Family is, we all have our little rituals, and it makes us belong, it gives us identity, and we trust it. So if suddenly Granny stopped doing Christmas the way we expected it, we would also feel very anxious, and that's what happens in our children's lives when we suddenly say, sorry, no time for a book tonight, jump into bed, go to sleep, no story. Their world is shattered. So predictability and safety, absolutely.
The sad thing is, though, that the space for that bonding time is minimized in today's society. We're all so busy. We've got very busy lives, busy most many host households with two working parents, etc. The stats tell us that there is a decreasing amount of that reading together happening. Is that something that concerns you, Elizabeth?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that even in the rush of it, we can create it. It doesn't have to be hours. Mm. It's that mindful, focused time that you spend with your children. I mean, I'm a working mum, and it's not easy. But we can carve it, most definitely. Meal times, bedtime, there's time. Mm. There is.
As a speech therapist in particular, I'd like you to speak a little bit about the role of reading and reading aloud in particular in the child's language development.
Well, are you talking about reading to the child or the child reading to you?
Let's do both. Let's start with to your child.
Let's start with reading to your child. In fact, we could even go further back. It starts with talking to your child. And basically by about three, children have heard, the average kid has heard 20 million words spoken in their environment. Okay? Mm. A child who spends time in a highly stimulated language environment has heard 35 million words. They're not all jushy smart words. They're just words. And children who don't have that have heard about 10 million words. And we know that kids' narrative ability, their ability to tell their own stories, predicts their success at school and their literacy skills.
Really?
Yeah. So vocab is huge, and you've got to talk before you even read to them. And of course, reading to children prepares them for something called decontextualized language. You're taking it out of that oral where you've got the gestures and the sound effects. And actually, in a book, you have to have words and nouns. And reading it again and again increases a child's vocab.
Okay. There's an interesting question here from Irene. Irene, where are you in the room? Thank you so much for a great question. Irene's wondering about, never mind reading in the first language, what about introducing a second language from a very young age? In her case, mom and dad, both English first language, would like to introduce a second language. We were always told that the sooner you start, the younger you are when you start learning a language, the easier it is to learn and the longer lasting it will be. Is there not a risk of confusing children when they're still bedding down the concepts and the vocab of their own first language?
I think children are wired for language. All right, so the most important thing is the language model. So if your mother tongue is English, then speak English. If you want to introduce another language, it's always good to have somebody who, it's the mother tongue. It comes naturally. It's not forced. It's natural. So, children are wired for as many languages as they as they're exposed to. So don't limit them. We know that children who are exposed to more than one language can sometimes take a little bit longer. Don't panic. They'll get there. And we also know that children who've got learning barriers sometimes will find that second language difficult. But if it's the mother tongue and they're being educated in a different language, mother tongue is so important. So yes, lots of languages.
Okay, it's something I'm going to discuss in more detail with Nali Bali, because we know one of the big problems in this country in particular is the lack of availability of reading material in a variety of languages for so many children. I think it's something like 90% of South Africans under the age of 7 have no reading material available in their home language. So that's something we'll go to in a couple of minutes. But just to bring us back to what you were saying, okay, we've spoken a bit about reading to children. What about the child learning to read themselves and the role of reading out loud to a parent who's listening? How important is that?
It's essential. We're actually, our brains aren't wired up for reading. We've got like all the stuff in our brains for language. Mm. And we learn reading based on our language circuitry. And you have to wire it up. So they've got to do it a lot. And they've got to hear. They've got to get the feedback loop. So absolutely. I mean, teachers are always saying 10 minutes a day reading. But I want to just talk to something that Roxanne said. It's that time together, and it's the reading relationship that can make or break it for a reluctant reader or a dyslexic reader, any reader. So if it's a safe time, and errors are actually treasures. Mm-hmm. And that is, you need to be fascinated by the mistakes children make, because that's how they learn. So yes, reading aloud.
And reading as a two-way process. I've heard it said that it's really important to let your children digress from what they're reading, ask a question, lose their focus on the actual words and say, Mom, what's that in the tree? What's that picture about? Roxanne, why is that so important?
You are showing your child that they have a voice. Mm-hmm. And you're showing your child that questioning is an asset. And so they will ask more questions. And if you look in a classroom full of children, who are the children that are confident enough to say, I don't know, you lost me two sentences ago. What did you ask? Why is it that way? They are the ones that usually do the best, because they've become their own vessel of knowledge, and they're not afraid to fill up from different sources. And so I think that parents need to also be okay with not knowing. So if a child asks, and it's maybe you're reading and it's not your mother tongue, or there's a word that you have no idea what that means, to say, I don't know. But you know what? We never full. We're not a tank, and once we full, we go out into the world. We're always learning. So let's find out together. Let's Google this, or you know, let's ask Dad, or whatever you need to do. And then that also shows your child that you are not perfect. There is no such thing as perfect, and you're in this together. And I think that is wonderful. Be a confident learner.
I know we have Sharon Stansfield in the audience, who's another retired occupational therapist. Sharon, can you just identify yourself? Thank you so much for joining us today. And Sharon mailed me when she heard we were doing this segment to tell us she's also passionate about reading, so much so that, in fact, she's written a book called Teach Your Child to Read with Movement, Fun, and Games. And I'm intrigued by the fact, Sharon, that movement is so big a part of that. Can we just get the roving mic across to Sharon? Because that implies the very title, that this is more than just a seated affair with a book in front and a single focus, that you believe there are many other sensory processes involved.
Absolutely, Pippa. What Elizabeth said earlier is that the brain isn't wired for reading. We're wired, can you hear me better
yes,
now? We're
you.
Wired for language, and we use our language circuitry. So in fact, to learn to read, we have to have what's known as bilateral integration, because we've got both sides of our brain have to work together to be able to take that information, which is effectively a visual code, a sequence. It represents a sound. These are interpreted on different sides of the brain. They have to be brought in at the same time, and then they have to tie up with whatever it is that the word represents, a cat, and then we have to tie it to language. So movement gives you the ability to make those connections that Elizabeth was talking about, to make that brain work across. Movement also brings in rhythm. And reading and language require rhythm and sequencing, which is tied in with our vestibular processing, which is tied in with movement again. The other funny thing about reading is our eyes are like the old-fashioned video cameras before they brought in stabilizers. And so there's a lot of movement happening while we're reading, and we need our vestibular processing to help our brain do what our modern cameras are doing and to stabilize mm-hmm. what the world is, what those words are as they come in. Again, movement. So the reason I started that program is because I had lots of little children coming to me doing OT with sensory integration problems, attention problems, and everything was going great. They were improving in many areas, but somehow that last little bit, turning it into reading, didn't come together, and so I decided I had to somehow tie those loose ends together.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your book with us, and Sharon's graciously given us a copy to give away to a member of the audience today, which I'll announce at the end of the show. Thank you so much for being here. I believe we've got a question that's come in by voice note. Let's take a listen.
Pippa, what a brilliant show. I just want to let you know I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, both boys, both vivid imaginations, and sometimes if I can't reach to find the book, I make the story up. And I was beginning to think maybe I should write a few books because I'm having so much fun doing it. And that's the point, is to have fun and to enjoy that time with your kids and grow their imagination. And they both have a great love of books and a great love of language. And the ability of my 4-year-old to articulate his words is outstanding. And I'm loving this journey, and I love the idea of this show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for saying one of the magic words I hadn't said yet, which is the word imagination. I see both Elizabeth and Roxanne nodding vehemently here. Elizabeth, how important a role is the role of storytelling and reading in developing a child's imaginative ability? Oh,
it's everything. I mean, reading's a visceral experience. We can talk all about brain circuitry and stuff, but the words and the pictures. I mean, Nikki, I was just reading some of your books, and there's one girl with a boombox voice. I mean, what are you teaching children? You're teaching them to abstract. You know, you're teaching them to not be concrete. You're teaching them metaphor at 3 and 4 and 5.
Without knowing it.
Yes, and they can see it because words paint pictures, and that's what a good writer does.
We're going to hear from someone who does exactly that after the news headlines. Just before we go to news, though, I can't miss the opportunity, having mentioned storytelling, to bring in Ross in Pinelands, if I may, Ross. If you were at the latest Petra Kucha, you might have heard his speech. Well, it wasn't a speech. Ross got up and told a story, a children's story, to, I think it was 1,000 people at City Hall, and you couldn't have heard a pin drop, Ross. You're involved in storytelling to children on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'm certainly. I've got more questions than answers here. It's really been great. One of the things I just need to tell you is that I had a book open with some of the grandchildren, and I was told by Sophia, I don't want a book story, I want a story from your brain. So, and I thought I'd... I think that especially from a man's point of view, I found it a tremendous gift to be able, given the opportunity, to actually tell stories to children. And the imagination I endorse greatly.
Ross, won't you just remind, for those listening at home, you're thinking, wow, that's something I would love to be able to do. What's the name of the program that you're involved with?
Well, there are a number. The one is the Story Club, which meets the last Wednesday of every month at 7 o'clock down at St. Matthew's Church in District 6. And that is great fun. And then the other one that I'm involved in is actually Teach, Love and Care. And people would have to, I think, contact me for that. But there is actually a website as well. Just Google Teach, Love and Care.
Thank you very much, Ross. Okay. Quick question before we head to the news, and it's such an important one from Bradley in Meadow Ridge, asking, is it safe to teach your child to read on an iPad or a tablet? Does it matter, Roxanne, what the reading material is they're working with?
I have to take this question because I don't have time for all these children. There's too many of them to come to me personally. So when you use an iPad, the difficulty that I face in my practice is that their eyes become stuck. They get this iPad syndrome. Their visual focus and their length of their focus is about 20 centimeters, and they can't visually track, which means moving from left to right. It's what you were touching on about the movement earlier. And you know, when we were in the 80s walking around watching TV, at least we were walking around and watching it. But with the iPad, you're stationary, your posture is fixed in flexion, your eyes are fixed. And so these kids, they don't know how to share because your iPad is your property. It usually excludes mum and dad. It's great if you can come into that. But also what I find is often my kids are so distracted by when you're reading about Little Red Riding Hood, you touch on an apple and it goes bing, boing, bong, which is great, but it's not really the point of reading the story. And so they're so distracted by bing, boing, bong, bing, boing, bong, and I'm so distracted by bing, boing, bong that we don't even get through the story. And then, of course, there's two of them in my house, so they're fighting over who gets to do the bing, boing, bong on every page. And I'm just fed up, you know, by the end of it, and so are they. So I think if you create a threshold in your children's lives where things are so entertaining, it's very difficult to go towards a white piece of paper with black writing on it, because the brain has gotten accustomed to this visual input. And we need kids to be able to sit still and have a stationary object that they're looking at and to be able to examine it and explore it and be curious about it with their eyes. And so, yes, please, you can use iPads, but maybe use something simple and do it together if possible.
Thank you for that. You're listening to our Parent Talk live studio audience, brought to you by KidZone. We deliver smiles.
Cape Talk, Family Matters.
This Parent Talk live studio audience is brought to you by KidZone. We deliver smiles. And one of the reasons KidZone partnered with us on this event today is that, of course, they sell books and children's books specifically on their website, retail outlets. So thank you to them for making this event possible today. We are going to bring Roxanne and Elizabeth back into the conversation towards the end of the show. So to the one or two questions that came through during the news, we will go back. But in the meantime, I want to bring in our next two guests today. And firstly, to say welcome and lovely to have you with us in person after many years talking on the phone. Jade Jacobs is the current MD of Nali Bali, the national campaign that aims to build a culture of reading and storytelling in South Africa. We've spoken to them often on the show. It's lovely to have you with us today, Jade.
Thank
welcome.
You very much for having us.
We've heard the case very conclusively for why reading is so important for physical development, for language development, for our emotional development. It's really that last, the emotional development, I wanted to chat to you about today and to take you back to that stat I mentioned earlier of how few children have access to reading material in their home language. What are they missing out on, in Nali Bali's opinion, if they don't have access to being able to read books in their own language?
Well, maybe if I can start by just kind of setting the context that children are working in South Africa. 46% of storybooks that exist in South Africa are written in English, 24% are in Afrikaans. You're looking at Zulu and look at isiXhosa, and then you're looking at 6%. By the time you get to Ndebele, you're looking at 1% of children's storybooks. So most children are learning to read in a language that is not the language that they think in. So what are they missing out on? I think the primary thing is instant meaning, so comprehension of what they're reading. And how can you fall in love with something if you don't understand instantly what it is that you're reading?
Thank you for setting that framework for us. I mean, I know 17 million plus children in South Africa. Do we know how many of them are being read to on a regular basis?
So we know that about 5% of parents don't, or 5% of the parents think that it's important to read to children before they're able to read to themselves, and about 35% of parents do actually read to their children at all, which isn't very much at all.
That's very low indeed. Yeah. Obviously, that's something that you as Nali Bali are trying to change and are making a lot of inroads in doing. I'm interested to hear your response to the question about reading on an iPad or a device, because I know one of the things Nali Bali has done is gone, we know that books are expensive, we know that not everybody has access to big bookstores where they can go in and browse and choose and then afford to buy. You've put stories into the hands of parents wherever you can get them, including using mobile technology.
Yeah, so for us, we are not purists anyway. We can't afford to be purists. We have, as you say, just under 18 million children in this country, and Nali Bali plans to make sure that every single child has an opportunity to fall in love with stories. And so we can't say it must be on an iPad, or it mustn't be on an iPad, or it must be a newspaper story, or it must be in a magazine, or it must be in a book. We just want children reading. So I think if there are children who, the ideal scenario is a mom and a dad sitting together in a beautiful context, reading a beautiful storybook where the child actually gets to touch the book themselves, because a lot of parents in this country are terrified of and teachers are terrified of actually letting children physically touch books. But that isn't something that we can guarantee. So as far as Nali Bali believes we want children to engage with books and stories in whatever fashion they can get hold of books and stories.
Thanks for that. You make me think immediately of Ethel Williams, who's been a guest on the show before, from Read to Rise. Ethel is the co-founder of the organization Read to Rise. And he described for me, one of the things that they do is take multiple copies of a purpose-written children's story into schools so that every child receives their own book and there's a space on the front page to write in that child's name. And till the day I die, will never forget Ethel's description of the look on the child's face opening that book and seeing their name on the front page and realizing it was theirs to own, to play with, to mess up, to scribble on if they wanted to, because it's such a rare thing for children to have that, many children in South Africa.
Yeah.
I know that you don't, A, insist on the format of which the reading happens, and B, you don't insist on actually reading written word. You're also very big on promoting the culture of storytelling, not just story reading. You've actually got your big Story Bossa campaign underway as we speak. Won't you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely, and for the radio listeners, I'm all dolled up thanks to my comms team and all the paraphernalia for the competition. But September is Heritage Month as well as Literacy Month, and we know that despite the fact that many South Africans do not consider themselves to be readers, we have a really, really strong storytelling culture that spreads across every ethnic group, every culture in this country. So for the month of September, for the last couple of years, Nali Bali has been running the Story Bossa competition. For this month, we have 113 events that have sprung up across the country. We have four or five big events that take place across the country. It was kicked off in Johannesburg on the 31st of August. Mark Luttering assisted us with that, and we had story cards that were printed out with insomnies. So we want folk tales. Thank you. So we want to revive this culture of storytelling, and we're doing it through this competition.
It's wonderful that you're doing that, and Nali Bali does amazing work. How far away are you from the conclusion of the competition? If someone listening has their ears pricking up at that, is it too late to enter?
I would highly recommend that those who have their ears pricking up get onto our website, and you'll see a number of ways that you can still enter the competition. You can be an adult, you can be a child, you can be an adult and a child, you can be a group of children. Mm-hmm. You can enter by yourself. It doesn't really matter. But the key thing is that you tell the story in the language that is most comfortable to you. So we're collecting South African stories in all South Africa's languages, and it can be a story that you've retold or a story you've made up by yourself. But we are running this until the end of the month. There is a Western Cape event coming up later this week, just before Heritage Day, and there are a number of other events. So people can go onto our website and take a look what is happening if they would like to physically go to an event. Otherwise, submit a story online.
Thank you, Jade. Now, speaking of collecting stories, I know we've got someone in the audience who's busy collecting books and trying to set up reading rooms in his community. Jeff, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. You're a former high school principal, aren't you?
Yeah, good afternoon. Right. Papa, thanks for the opportunity. It's great to be in the company of like-minded people. I'm the founder of an organization called Reading and Writing Solutions, and I'm excited to be in the company of you passionate people. We do reading interventions at schools. Thus far, I've trained over 600 volunteers that go there to do an intervention with a weak reader. And you're saying all the right things. Roxanne, you mentioned a repetition. I was saying with the volunteers, the reading tutors, repetition is the hallmark of success. But my concern is the lack of reading material. Hence, we've embarked on a project. I have next to me, to my right, the owner of a plot of land, which has donated to us. Mr. Shaheen Ryan, whom I want to thank, and he asked me, you use the land, and being passionate about reading, I've decided with our volunteers to construct the 10 reading rooms. Ross, you're sitting at the right place. I'm going to invite you to come and read stories there once a month, and to create this buzz around reading. I'm excited for Nali Bali because the kids that we work with, there's always a lack of reading material. So for these 10 reading rooms we'll be erecting there, it will be organized in the phases of the school system, right? Early childhood foundation phase, intermediate phase, and a room only cost us 220,000. I'm here to appeal for help, right? The total project would be 3.6 million, and my volunteers, they give so much of themselves. We only reliant on fundraising. And the buzz we want to create inside these reading rooms where kids can come and read, and the tutors will read to them. It will be a community center where adults can read. We'll have Saturday reading sessions. But actually, I wanted this as it yesterday. My biggest problem is the funding, right? So how do we promote a culture of reading if we don't have an accessible facility in a community? Our venue will be in Thornton Road, Athlone, near to the site of the Trojan Horse Massacre. We also want to create a Trojan Horse Massacre reading room. I have all the book partners. I need the rooms. So I appeal for assistance to people out there. Right, we've worked to at least have one reading room up and running by November. I need 9 more. And kids can come in there and read, and we read to them. And thank you for this great show. I think we should have this once a week. And
I wish we could. I wish we could.
To get the message out there. Thank you, ma'am.
Jeff Paulson, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. And there's somebody wanting to respond immediately to what you've just said.
Well, I would like to support the concept of reading aloud, telling stories. And we have a tool. It's a whisper phone, South Africa's very own tool for a self-amplification. The child or storyteller or actor whispers into the phone, and they hear their own voice echo back to them loudly and clearly. We're finding that it improves language development, love of reading, it pulls the children into the book, and most of all, it enables children to better comprehend. They might stop and say, hey, what I just read doesn't make sense. Let me go back and read again. And we also get the children to think out loud. They read a passage, they change hands and then say, well, what do I think about that? Or what does that mean? Or that reminds me of. And so we have the children going backwards and forwards between the author's words and their own mind. The Sabezaphone is in many Cape Town schools, over 1,000. We've done it in primary school, and it's in the country from the rural school. I'm not the rural schools, the previous disadvantaged areas, the townships, as well as Pretoria Boys High. They're using it for editing their writing. So it's called the Sabezaphone. Sebezaphone.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be able to put the two of you together. And just to say, if anybody is interested either in supporting Jeff's reading rooms or in finding out more about Sabezaphone, please send me an email to pippah@capetalk.co.za and we'll connect the dots, as it were, for everyone. I've had my fourth guest waiting very patiently, and he's come a very long way to be here today. So I think without further ado, I must welcome children's author and illustrator Nikki Daly, who's come through from Claremont to join the conversation today. And the applause says it all. The applause says it all, because Nikki is one of our most acclaimed South African children's writer. He's won a string of awards for it. He's been nominated for some of the leading children's literature awards in the world, including the Astrid Lindgren Award and the Hans Christian Andersen Award. My children loved your books when they were a little bit younger, Nikki. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Pippa, for inviting me.
I really wanted to get a perspective from somebody who approaches this issue from the opposite end. You said about writing stories that children will love to read and that parents will love to share with their children. How do you do that? How do you get into the mind of a child when you set about wanting to tell a story?
Well, I suppose the impulse to start a story comes from different places. One of them can be, you know, the real world. I see people, I hear people, I am inspired by things that I see, especially if they amuse me. And then there are memories that I have from my own childhood that surface, and sometimes they intermingle with that event that I've just seen. And then, of course, there is just kind of, you know, the working imagination that comes when you least expect it sometimes. If you're lucky, it comes in the early morning when you're half asleep and awake, and boom, it lands right on your pillow, a wonderful idea that you can work on. So there's a great deal of magic and inexplicable sort of impulses that finally makes a person a writer and an illustrator.
Now, I'm interested in hearing about your process, because just a couple of days ago we recorded an interview with one of the world's leading children's writers, Julia Donaldson, who wrote The Gruffalo and many others, and with her illustrator, Axel Scheffler. And I was quite surprised to hear them say that they work completely independently of one another. Julia produces the words and the story, it gets handed to Axel, and he then sets about illustrating it. Mm. You obviously do both yourself. What's your process? What comes first? The story, the concept, the words, the pictures? What does all happen together?
Yeah, well, if you see my sketchbook or my notebook, it's a manifestation of the chaos that's actually going on in my head, because it's a total kind of interaction between drawings that I do, writing that I do simultaneously. Sometimes one comes before the other, and through it all, the story emerges. It becomes refined. There are processes of doing that. You know, as a writer, you learn certain sort of a craft about writing and illustrating, and you draft it out either as a storyboard or a dummy book. And by the end of that process, even your rough sketches and your writing that still is open for editing should be enough to convince a publisher that this is an idea worth putting their money into, because producing picture books is a very quick way of losing money.
<That's terrible.
laughs> More quick losing money than making money, because you know, there are fewer people who can either afford to buy books or who have a book culture that they books are part of their lives.
Yeah. Nikki, I know you've been very big on writing books that reflect the country that we are in all its diversity. Your books have been very multicultural. Mm. Has it been a deliberate decision on your part that you wanted all South African children to be able to see themselves reflected in your work?
You know, I think it sort of started when I came back to South Africa, and it was the beginning of me looking at what was available for children, and it was very limited, specifically for black children. You hardly ever saw black children in children's books at that time, and if you did see them, they were token. They were part of a farm rural setup, and because I was also reflecting on my own childhood, I was, you know, sort of I was born in 1946, no secrecy about that. And my generation spent a lot of time on the street. We played in the street. And that's where a lot of adventures took place. That's where life kind of happens, you know, in the street. When I came back to South Africa at the beginning of the 80s, there was no street life. Nobody was in the street. The children weren't playing as we used to play, but they were playing in the townships. When I passed the townships, I could see that there were children out there playing. And I think that in order to draw in my experience of, you know, what happens when you're on the street, those Jamela books started to come forward.
And that's grown into a series, Jamela, that's been probably your
most
successful
to date. Yes, I started with
one.
I didn't think that I would, you know, be following it up, but it turned out to be five of the Jamela series.
Yeah. Now, there's a new book out which I have to mention, and we got a sneak preview this morning. Surprise, surprise is Nikki's new book, which has a corkscrew twist in the tale, because it is the tale of a little pig. Nikki, out with NB Publishers, which is an imprint of Tafelberg, is the book available in stores already? Or is
Yes. In English, Afrikaans, and I think it's just English and Afrikaans, yeah.
Okay, it's an absolutely glorious read, and we had to steal it back from my producer, Amy, who's got a very young daughter at home, and she wanted to take it home, but we did say we'd give a copy away to somebody in the audience today, so again, I'll announce that winner at the end of the show. How long does it take you from the start of the process to seeing Surprise, Surprise in all its beautiful piggy glory before us?
Yeah, well, I think once I've actually got the idea, then to start writing and illustrating it, I normally allow myself at least 3 months. Mm. And I'm a quick worker. There are people who take a lot longer. But between the time that you know, I've actually started the process of doing the book, it can take up to 2 years before that book actually is on the shelves. It's a long, long time. Quicker in South Africa, but much longer when you're publishing overseas.
Nikki, thanks so much for continuing to produce these absolute gems of children's literature.
Well, thank
you. And if you've never read one, please Parents, do yourselves a favor. Nikki Daly, and that's spelled N-I-K-I, surname D-A-L-Y. The new book is Surprise, Surprise, in stores now. Before we run out of time, there are a couple of questions that come through on our SMS line, which I'd like to pose, and they may involve our two earlier guests, Roxanne and Elizabeth, as well. Amy, if you can stand by with the microphone. I love this. Dion is SMS asking whether childhood reading equates to fewer adult spelling errors. He goes on in the next message to say, my spelling is atrocious. Well, you spelled that correctly, Dion. But he says, my mom always says it's because I never read as a child. Elizabeth, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, sure. I think if you are wired nicely and easily for reading and writing, there's no glitches in the family history. I think, yeah, reading will help spelling, will help writing. It's this beautiful massage that happens. But if you've got a few little glitches, I mean, I've got plenty in my family, you can learn, you can get wired up for reading, and you can be a fantastic reader. And you can go on to be a dreadful speller forever and ever. Amen. And that's okay, because, you know, John Irving, some of the best writers have had spelling problems. So don't worry, listener.
Okay. Thank you
for
that.
It's okay. There's no such thing as the spelling police.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And there's spell check.
Thank goodness for that. We also had a call. Shame. Carol called in during the news, and we weren't able to take her call. But I know she was asking for advice on teaching autistic children to read. Are there specific elements there, Roxanne, that you'd like to touch on?
It goes back to what I said about joint attention. And so with our autistic kids, if I can give any parents out there who may have kids under 3 and they're not yet speaking and their social skills don't look to be great and they're not yet diagnosed, one of the simplest things you can do is to sing stories to kids to try and have movement with it. So holding hands, eye contact, and a little bit of joint attention, and singing a very simple song and stopping and waiting for them to make a sound like up or down or boogie, 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 whatever it is. And that will help your child a lot to start communicating with just eyes and vocalizations.
Thank you for that. And good luck, Carol. Carol's actually just sent a follow-up saying, I'm teaching a 9-year-old autistic child who is verbal. She's just started taking a book away from me and pointing while I read, which she thinks is wonderful progress. So do my guests. You're getting a big thumbs up here, Carol, so keep with it. Nikki, one for you. Somebody SMSing to ask which children's authors inspired you as a child and inspired your work today.
Well, firstly, I can't remember having any children's books as a child. I discovered children's books after I had been to art college and was interested in finding a vehicle for my drawing. Then I discovered the greats, and they are certainly Morris Sendak was the first person that I looked at and virtually used to feel ill just looking at his work because it was so brilliant. and mostly from the old school of illustrators, Charles Keeping is a great illustrator. Edward Ardizzone of the Tim books is an illustrator, again, that taught me a lot. And I often give advice to people who ask, you know, how do I go about learning about children's books, is that you spend a lot of time in a children's library just looking at books, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, seeing the books you like and you don't like. Mm. Yeah.
I'm so glad you mentioned the library, because you reminded me to share an email which came in from Jill, who's a regular listener in Rosebank. And she wrote to me when she heard we were doing this segment today to share the memories that she cherishes of reading to her children and with her children. And she said, we started reading to our babies when their heads were still wobbly. We'd take turns between the two parents when we only had one child. And later when we had two, we would swap nights so that we were reading to both children. Those books allowed us a shared history and, in some cases, a new vocabulary. She goes on to say, though, every Thursday evening, after bath and supper, in their PJs, we would take them all off to the Rondebosch Library, which was open until 8 in those days. And the baby came in the carry cot and got his library card shortly after his birth. She says, Dad read aloud the last book of their childhood, which was The Lord of the Rings. And I can only imagine that must have been a very late end to the reading aloud. Jill, your children have a history and a treasury of stories that you've shared with them. Well done for keeping it going as long as up to Lord of the Rings. And may that be an inspiration to everybody else. That is where we have to wrap up our on-air conversation. I'm happy to take a few extra questions from the audience members after we've handed over to the news team. But I do need to say a huge thank you to all of our guests, author Nikki Daly, Jade Jacobson of the Nalibali campaign, Roxanne Atkinson, who is our pediatric occupational therapist, as well as Elizabeth Nadlini, our speech therapist. Thank you all for being part of the show today. I really hope you've enjoyed it here in the audience and to those listening at home as well.